Hello and welcome to the First Take Film Club podcast. I'm your host, Connor Norcott, and today I'm joined by my two good pals, Liam Jones and Luke Chandley. Liam, how are you, mate?
Yeah, good, mate. Quite tired. I worked most of the night doing an inventory take at my new job. Well, not my new job, I've been there a while now, but at a supermarket, which was horrific. So I actually only woke up an hour ago from my nighttime sleep, as it was. So yeah, fun. I'm not feeling fresh, but I'm actually like my brain feels awake. I just feel a bit gross. So good to go.
You look pretty fresh, to be fair. And you know what?
I really don't. I've got like I've not had a haircut in 2 months. I've not shaved in 2 months. I'm like a scruff right now.
Tom Hanks in Castaway.
Yeah, genuinely. It's not that I can't even afford to. The reason I won't get my hair cut is because I found a really good hairdresser/barbers that I went to. And the first time she didn't really talk to me fine. The second time she started speaking to me about the BLM movement. And she said some very, very questionable things that was actually, quite frankly, really unacceptable. And I just like was sat there with my mask on. And I was like, please don't talk to me about this whilst you're cutting my hair. This isn't what I want to talk to. This is what I want when someone's cutting my hair. So I won't go back to her. And it's like she cut my hair really well as well. So now I'm like trying to find a new place that will cut my hair well, but won't be racist at the same time.
Yeah,
it's one of those things.
It's a fine balance.
Yeah,
this is not where I thought the podcast was going to go already, but you know, we move, as we say.
We move.
And Luke, mate, how are you? I can't see you because your screen's muted at the minute. But how are you, mate?
Yeah, I'm all right. Thank you very much. Yeah, I have been on the weather for a few days, and I haven't actually even showered today, so I haven't got my screen on at all. Yeah, that's how I feel. I'm all right, though. Yeah, I'm fine. I've spent the day watching things I've never seen before. No Country for Old Men and the David Attenborough documentary that's on Netflix. So, it's been an all right day. I'm going to, for the first time in my new place, I've took my duvet down onto the couch to just lie on the couch.
There's nothing
honestly
better than that.
It felt amazing. So I'm going to do that a little bit later, maybe stick a bit of Harry Potter on and just have a big mug of cocoa and have a dream. So, but yeah, I'm good. How are you, mate?
I'm good. You know, I think, I don't normally host and I was a little bit nervous, but after Liam's kind of rant and your illness, I feel like nothing can go wrong. I'm feeling pretty good.
We've gone
I have had a shower today, but I don't really feel like clean, if I'm honest. I've just been in work cleaning a cellar for like an hour.
Oh, why?
So yeah, I think I'm doing okay. Luke, like you mentioned, you watched No Country for Old Men, and that's the film we're doing on this week's episode. It's one I've been dying to watch, and I think when we got into lockdown I ended up just watching it. It was going to be my first take months ago, and you know, Corona put us on hold, so now it's actually Liam and Luke. It's your first take as well, boys, isn't it?
It is indeed. I've been wanting to watch this film for ages, obviously. Excuse me, I've just downed a coffee and regurgitated a little bit. It's a great start to the pod today. I've been wanting to watch this film for ages. Obviously, Best Picture winner, Coen Brothers, who are great. Javier Bardem, who's great. Josh Brolin, who's great. The other guy, I forget his name, Tommy Lee Jones, who's great. He's great in Men in Black anyway, but you know. and yeah, finally watched it yesterday. I have to say, I watched it under strange circumstances. I was under stress. It was transfer deadline day in the football world yesterday, and as a Manchester United fan, it was a horrible day, stressful day, and I think my mind was elsewhere. Not to mention, I knew as I was watching it that when the film finished at like 10 o'clock, I wouldn't be going to bed. I would be just staying awake because I, you know, have to go straight to work.
Oh yeah.
And work through the night. So it was a weird one. It was weird circumstances I watched it. But I've got the film on now in the background on mute. I've rewatched like the last 10 minutes as well, about half an hour ago. And I feel like now I'm like in the zone of the film. I feel like we are one. I am now. Yeah, definitely.
Okay, cool. So before we get onto that, let me just throw an opening question your way, as we like to do. Normally we try and tie these into the actual film we're doing, and I couldn't really think of a good one in such a short period of time. So I thought, let's just ask, who's your favorite old man in cinema? We've got all the time for old men.
This is a good question. Favorite old man in cinema? Oh, how old are we talking old man?
So I've got about 7 different answers. So you just pick an old man from any time in cinema, really, and we'll talk about
okay, well, I'm okay, well, I think maybe Tom Hanks class is old now because he's 60.
Oh, shit. Okay, yeah.
So maybe Tom Hanks. Mm-hmm. Who else? My old man.
Can I ask just before you guys go into your answers, can we try and think of an old man character in a film? Do you get me? So, for instance, I've written down Alan Arkin's character, the grandpa character in Little Miss Sunshine.
Oh, yes.
Amazing. And that was a film that I think it was my first take, wasn't it? A couple of months, well, about a year ago now on the podcast. And I didn't love it that much. But now that I look back on it, his character reminds me kind of in a really strange way of my granddad. I just thought I'd shut him out.
I would have to, if you're going for a character... I'll give a character and I'll give an actor just in general. So the character for me, Richard Harris's Dumbledore in the first 2 Potter films.
Yeah.
He is so warm and sweet and kind and thoughtful and wise. And he just plays him so brilliantly.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder why they did cast him, though, when he was very old by the time they cast him. I'm not actually sure... I don't think they actually planned on, you know, doing the whole 8 films in the end. But, you know, in the first 2 films, he's absolutely amazing. Mm-hmm. I think Michael Gambon's cool, but he plays him so much harsher. But I guess he's written a lot harsher as the books go on. But yeah, that's my character.
Mm-hmm.
My actor... I think it's another great shout by me. I'm blowing my own trumpet again, like I did last week. Sir Ian McKellen all day long
for me. You picked the 2 old wizards. I appreciate that.
Yeah. The 2 old wizards. Mm-hmm. I think, like, you've got Gandalf, you've got him as, you know, a baddie as Magneto. I watched him the other day opposite Helen Mirren in a new film called The Good Liar, where he's really good in that. The film's not amazing, but he's really great in it. You know, showing that he can still do it at, like, what, 80 or however old he is, maybe pushing 80. Just a great guy. And whenever he comes on, you know, like the chat shows, he's always so funny. His anecdotes are brilliant.
He's always got a good story to tell.
Yeah.
Hasn't he?
He's always on the ball, you know, and he's obviously as well, like, his stage presence, you know, obviously studied him in school playing... oh my God, which Richard is it?
Richard III?
Yeah, the Shakespeare. Yeah, mm-hmm. The Shakespeare play. Yeah, we studied him in that as well. And he's just great. He's just awesome. A brilliant actor and a brilliant guy. And that's my favorite. These are my 2 favorite old people.
Good shout,
off the top of my head.
Luke, I'm going to throw to you, if you don't mind. And I know you answered Tom Hanks earlier, but I'd like if you could pick maybe a performance from him or perhaps another old dude who gave a really good performance that you want to shout out.
I'll pick another old dude. Bill Murray, I think. I think Bill Murray.
Elite answer.
And what I really like is, so obviously I like him in all of the Wes Anderson films. I also quite like him in this film that I think got maybe mixed reviews. It was like not a short film, but not feature length on Netflix, called A Very Murray Christmas. A Christmas film, and I really fucking like it. I think it might be directed by Sofia Coppola, because I was on a Wikipedia the other day when I was looking into On the Rocks, and so I think that might be directed by her. But I just love it, and I think I don't know whether I love it because it's just got Bill Murray in it, and I love him, and it's actually quite a subpar film. But I'll go with Bill Murray in that.
I'm so used to watching Bill Murray in films, you know, from like the 80s and stuff where he isn't old, that I'd never picture him as an old man. Same with Tom Hanks. I never picture him as an old man. So your 2 shouts have like thrown me off because they actually are old men now.
Yeah.
And, it's really strange.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah.
Connor, what are your shouts?
I mean, I gave you two parameters to fill in, and I've only got characters. So I think I'm going to go back to another first tick of mine. Maybe I think it was about this time last year, and we did The Exorcist. And I know in the film, Max von Sydow might not have actually been as old as he was, you know, last year.
Oh, yeah, he had the prosthetics, yeah.
But he, you know, he's always been old. He's one of those guys that's always looked 60 minimum. And his performance in that as the kind of awesome, cool, you know, priest who's coming in to do the exorcism, I think he's just so awesome. He's so cool. He's like a champion for good versus evil and all that.
And he's also the tree crow thing in Game of Thrones, isn't he?
He is, and I didn't really want to mention that one, but, you know, he's good as that as well, as the tree crow thing. And a special shout-out to Carl from Up, you know, the old man in Up.
Oh, yeah.
I know he's not a real dude, but he is to me. I loved him.
That's great, that.
All right, cool. So we'll move on to the film for this week, and that is No Country for Old Men. Like Liam touched on earlier, it's a 2007 Oscar winning, I think it won Best Film, didn't it? It won over No Country for Old Men as well as a lot of others. Directed and written by the Coens, adapted from the Cormac McCarthy novel of the same name, which honestly, you know, if you're a fan of watching a film and then reading the book, or reading the book and then watching the film, the Cormac McCarthy novel of this is unbelievable. And I'm not a massive fan of him as an author, but that book's awesome. Yeah, so I'll give a little brief synopsis then. So while out hunting, Llewellyn Moss finds the grisly remains of a drug deal gone wrong. And after finding a massive load of cash, of readies, of Wonga, he takes it and quickly flees and becomes hunted by Anton Chigurh, who's like this ruthless hitman. And then he's also being tracked by a sheriff called Sheriff Bell, who's played by Tommy Lee Jones. And the film kind of revolves around these three main characters and how their stories all kind of intertwine with each other. And it ends up becoming quite a solemn and morally ambiguous film. And I think that's probably one of the main reasons why it won the Oscars that it did. I've saw this film maybe three times now in the past couple of months. And every time I watch it, you just get little, it's one of those films you kind of pick new interpretations and you pick out little gems that you might have missed on your first or second watch. But it was both of you guys. It was your first text this week. So I'm going to come to you, Liam, first. What did you think? First impressions?
When the film finished, I was just kind of like, oh, was that... Because it ends kind of almost abruptly and a little bit ambiguously. So I kind of just sat there thinking, right. I don't know why I was expecting maybe a kind of a big kind of climactic end.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't that. But I feel like it's a film that you have to think about afterwards. It kind of like stays with you. And, you know, the more I think about it, the more, you know, the ending makes sense, the more the way it actually cuts at the end makes sense. I've just rewatched the closing monologue and definitely, you know, what he's talking about, and it all makes sense in the end to me, but it took me a second time to actually make total sense to me. Bearing in mind that actually yesterday when I did watch it, I probably wasn't 100% there with it, to be honest, which is that's a completely different conversation to be had though about, you know, watching films in the right headspace. I wasn't in a negative headspace or anything like that. It's just, I don't know if my attention was 100% there. And I think for a film like this, it has to be.
Yeah, I agree.
And yeah, I feel like it's actually made me want to watch it again though. Like there's so many amazing things about this film. I think the opening kind of shots, it's interesting. Obviously the Deacs, Roger Deakins. I didn't actually know that he was a cinematographer of this film, but as soon as it opened, I was like, it's Roger Deakins, isn't it? Mm-hmm. And then that went on, and I was like, yeah, of course it is. You know, like the silhouettes, the use of like shadowing. I don't know if there are more technical terms, Connor, you may know, but I think we kind of spoke about things like this, didn't we? There were a lot of techniques used in this film that are actually used in Casablanca, which we covered 2 weeks ago. It's just, it's beautifully shot. I think what I took most out of this is the camera work and the performance of Javier Bardem.
Oh, he's incredible, isn't he? Yeah,
he's just pure kind of psychotic evil, and he plays it in a way where you're always trying to think, why like this? What has happened in your life to make you this kind of insane murderer? Because he ultimately, it's set up as he is this assassin type who actually has a mission almost, but it ends with him almost disregarding the mission and just hell-bent on killing anyone in his way, rather than focusing on this kind of, you know, you have this, the main plot is this $2 million that's been stolen by Josh Brolin's character. It's one of those things. I feel like this happens a lot on the podcast, where the more we start speaking about a film, where we're not 100% sold on, the more we speak about it, the more we kind of realize that we actually enjoyed it way more than we did. And I think it only actually ever happens with films that are well made and well acted. You know,
I think that's a really good point, actually. Yeah,
because I think sometimes, you know, you watch a film and you don't talk about it. You just watch a film and that's it. You go to sleep. You wake up the next day and you don't talk about that film. You don't mention it to anyone, you know, you don't discuss it, you don't write about it, you don't do anything with it. So, you know, it could be an amazing film, yet it kind of almost dissolves into thin air because you don't really give it that time and that thought that sometimes films need. I've waffled a little bit, I know. it might be my tired little brain. I'm sure I've made sense there somewhere. And probably not really given my actual first take, but I'll just say that I thought it was good, and I'll leave it at that.
Well, just before I come to you, look, I'll just echo what you said, Liam. I think I watched it in not a very similar in terms of like the actual dynamics of how you watched it, but in a similar headspace where I think I watched it on a ferry back home. I bought it on like the Apple Store or something, watched it on my laptop. And I was in this weird cramped cabin, and it wasn't very dark, and you could hear everyone talking outside, and it just wasn't the right atmosphere to watch it in. And I remember when it finished, I was a bit like, all right, cool. I get a cool film. There's really cool things about it. There's really good moments, and it's a really beautifully made and well-written film. But the end left me feeling kind of cold. And now that I've watched it on multiple viewings, it really clicks with me and I really resonate with it. So for you, look, how did you find it?
Yeah, I found it really good. I like quite quickly into the film realized I think I'm going to like this film a lot. Mm-hmm. I think it's one of them. I didn't. I definitely thought it was definitely different to what I thought it was going to be. Definitely thought it was going to be slower. Definitely thought it was going to be darker. Now, I know that the subject matter is actually dark with quite a lot of murders in it, but I think in terms of, I just thought it was going to be a bit more eerie, maybe slightly a bit less welcoming. But quite soon on into the film, I got a different impression completely. And I think I texted you guys this morning when I would like, kind of, I watched it this morning, and I was kind of like, yeah, I'm into this film. But kind of what Liam said about the plus points were the shooting and the camera work and Javier Bardem, like that is like what I put on my notes. I think Bardem is like, I can't unsee him as the character he is in Skyfall anymore. But that's just unfortunate for him, I guess. But yeah. I just think he's really he plays psychotic quite well, clearly.
Also plays charming well, though, which actually made the fact that I recently have watched him in Vicky Cristina Barcelona, Woody Allen film. Well, that's Woody Harrelson who's in this film, actually. a Woody Allen film where he is so goddamn handsome and so charming and genuinely could chat the pants off of anyone. And also recently watched him again in Mother, where he's also, you know, quite handsome and quite like almost maybe overpoweringly masculine in a way, but still, you know, handsome and quite charismatic.
Yeah.
So I think having recently watched him play those type of characters to then go to this, where he is completely insane and, you know, he plays him so like deadpan and it's so kind of scary almost. He'd actually, if this film, if this film was kind of maybe they wanted to go down a different route, he definitely could be almost like a horror, horror character, like a villain in a horror film for sure.
I think that's one of those where, like I've touched on after multiple watches, and I'll not talk about this too much because like it's First Take Film Club, it's not multiple watch film club, that doesn't sound as good. On, you know, with the benefit of watching it maybe two or three times, you kind of get different tones and you focus in on different aspects of the film, and he is like, you know, Jason level, Freddy level, a proper horror figure.
Yeah.
And one thing I've, how I read this film and how I interpret it is each of the three main characters kind of represent a different moral level. So you've got him who's like the complete chaotic evil. He, all he is like, he's like a vehicle for destruction and murder and chaos and all things nasty, really. And then you've got Sheriff Bell, who's kind of this, he's a bit optimistic. He might be world weary, but he tries to see the good and he's always kind of reflecting on the good old times. And always wondering why these times can't be, you know, as good as they were, basically. And then you've got Llewellyn Moss in the middle, who's played by Josh Brolin. And I think he's also really, really good in this film.
Yeah, it's good, yeah.
This was the film that put him on the map, I read. I didn't realise.
I'd say, I can't like, think of him before this. I know, like, this.
He was a child actor, wasn't he? I think he was in The Goonies. But
he was,
yeah. And maybe some other films. But this was the film that put him on the map as like as an adult,
a serious actor as well,
as a grown up, yeah,
fully, yeah. So he, I kind of read him as like the, he's the middle ground, and he's caught in between this, you know, these two kind of paragons of different moralities, and you know, as we see in the film, it doesn't end up too well for him, does it?
No, I kind of see him almost as like an embodiment of like this American dream of just like grabbing you know that one chance, and that one chance is like the suitcase full of money, mm-hmm. and just kind of running with it, and then, you know, I feel like Javier Bardem, what's his character called,
Anton Chigurh,
he's almost like, you know, everything bad and evil about America that is almost like chasing him down. And obviously you have like this, it's almost I'm so bad with character names. Why can't I remember the characters in this film? Tommy Lee Jones is Tommy Lee Jones. I'm going to just get them up.
Sheriff Bell. Yeah.
Sheriff Bell. He's almost beginning to become overwhelmed with the amount of kind of evil and violence and kind of like all these, the cartels and the drug activity in the area. I think, does he not mention that, people used to not, like sheriffs used to walk around with no guns,
mm-hmm.
And that's like it's a stark kind of representation of the way the direction the world's going in. And you know, this is set, not that it's I think it's referenced once maybe that it's set in 1980, and it doesn't rely on the setting, I don't think at all, the time setting, I mean, but it is set in 1980. And it's kind of this period where, you know, the world is, you know, technology is advancing, but, you know, this area of Texas is still quite backwards in a way. You know, you've still got these, I know you still have them now, you know, the kind of gangs and stuff, but it's so desolate in places. And it's just almost, you know, it reminds me of like cowboy films, obviously, because it's the same, it's a similar setting. And it's that almost like desolate kind of really depressing location. So I think like, but then the Coen brothers do often pick quite desolate, vast landscapes, don't they? I mean, look at Fargo, and what's another film I'm thinking of by them. Anyway, yeah, that's Fargo comes to me when I'm thinking of this film
mm-hmm. as same like kind actually,
of the,
yeah.
with like their use of location mm-hmm. To kind of push the narrative along, I guess.
So yeah, just from there, then let's kind of jump to talking about the Coens as filmmakers and the filmmaking in this film. Liam, I know off air, and I think maybe in the group chat, you touched on how you wanted to talk about the editing. And I think that's a real key component of why this film is kind of as, I don't know, it's as easy to get into as it is. You wouldn't think a film as bleak and as kind of ambiguous as the ending might suggest would be this, I don't know, accessible. But the editing, it's really, I think it's very kind of, despite how solemn it is, it's quite quickly paced and you're always kind of going with the action. And yeah, if you want to touch on that.
I think the editing, bearing in mind that this film doesn't have a score, so you don't have music to create pace and create a feeling of kind of progression through the film or something, you know, gaining kind of momentum. So you do rely almost 100% for pace. You almost rely 100% on the editing to kind of distinguish the pace of the film. Rather, you know, a lot of times films might just make not 100% rely on the score, but I think having a score and having someone that can kind of, you know, portray a kind of change in speed through music, I think it's quite, it's, I feel, to me, that's easier than using editing. Mm-hmm. And I think what they do, because the Coens edit it, don't they? They edit this film.
Yeah.
What they do is they assume that the viewer, you know, has a head screwed on.
Love that about this film as well. Yeah.
You know, they don't over-explain things. You know, there are quite harsh cuts sometimes. Like it's like a faded transition almost, or like a fade to black for maybe a split second. And something happens in the cut to the next scene. Obviously we see the culmination of what's happened, but you yourself have to fill in the blanks. And it's that kind of, it's almost like a playfulness with the audience. And I think that's why films like this are so impactful and they end up becoming almost, you know, culty in a way. Not that obviously this one, Best Picture, I'm not saying that it's like, but it does have a cult following because of the kind of way that it's made, I in my opinion anyway.
Can I just jump in for a sec? I think a really, really good point to illustrate what you've just said is, look, obviously we're going to spoil the crap out of this film and I already kind of have anyway. The moment when Anton comes and visits Carla Jean is played by Kelly MacDonald and she's Llewellyn's wife, I think, maybe girlfriend. And she comes to visit him he comes to visit her and he's obviously going to kill her. And they have this kind of face-to-face kind of dialogue, they kind of square off with each other. And it cuts to black at the end of it. And you see him coming out of the house and he just kind of leans up against the post and checks the undersoles of his shoes. And the reason why you know why he's doing that is because earlier on, he lifts his shoes up after he's murdered someone so the blood doesn't get on his soles. He's quite particular about, you know, having clean shoes. And I just think that's really good because, you know, there's this kind of concept of 2 + 2 = 4 in filmmaking. I know that sounds really basic, but it's you give the audience information early on that is then applied and potentially twisted later on so they know how to decipher a film. And it's they really trust the audience to, like you said, Liam, have their head screwed on, be intelligent enough to put 2 and 2 together, and hopefully you get 4.
Yeah.
And I really like that about this.
While we're on that scene, I think that the whole coin toss element, you know, heads or tails, earlier on in the film, Anton. Mm-hmm. Do they call him Anton or do they call him Chigurh?
I think they could call him by a second name.
Because they only actually refer to his name once, don't they? When Carson Wells is speaking about him, I think he refers to his full name.
Yeah.
Anyway, he is, I think it is, and he's talking to the guy behind the checkout. And they're just you know, he's been weird because he is. And, you know, the guy at the checkout just being pleasant because he's a pleasant guy. And I think he mentions that he inherited the business that he's working at. And that, for some reason, really pisses Shiger off. Really, really. I see, that's another thing, that, you know, that when, you know, a character's so ambiguous and they add, there's a little detail here or there. There's one little shot where he's driving off in a car. And he looks in the mirror to kids cycling, like a group of kids cycling behind him. And I don't know, to me, that screams like he didn't have that when he was a kid. There's something, you know, some childhood trauma. Mm. It screams childhood trauma to me anyway. And back to the scene in the gas station. And he says, you know, heads or tails. And the man's, you know, it depends what's the outcome, you know. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to call heads or tails if I don't know what's going to become of it. And eventually he calls it, he gets it right, and he doesn't kill him. And then the scene you were just on about with Carla Jean, he says heads or tails, and she's like, no, because I know why you've come here. Mm-hmm. So I'm not going to play your game. Interestingly, in the book though, she does call it and she gets it wrong. Mm-hmm. Which I thought was very interesting that they decided not to go down that route. I think it works better, her calling him on this bullshit heads or tails thing, because it almost, you see a twitch in his eye when she says, I'm not playing it, because it's, he gets annoyed that she's not going to play by his rules, because everything is so meticulous. He's so meticulous in everything. There's one scene which I think it's amazing when he is cleaning his wound. It's almost satisfying to watch because he does it so almost perfectly. Mm-hmm. And it, you know, it's really interesting. And it also just, you know, he doesn't even wince. It goes to show that he is completely insane. There's something not right in his brain. But the more I'm talking about this film, the more I'm realizing that there are so many things about this that are quite brilliant. And, you know, there's a lot to be picked at. You know, when you're looking at the characters, the pacing of the film, the editing of the film, that 2 + 2 = 4, you know, it's almost, I guess, foreshadowing in a way. All these tropes. I was so surprised, by the way, to see Woody Harrelson in this film. I had no clue. I'm watching the film in the background. Well, I'm not really watching it, but it's on in the background and it's on the screen right now. I had no clue he was in this film.
Yeah.
For the short time he's in it. Can we talk about, I feel like we need to talk about the violence in this film. Obviously, Shiger has this shotgun with this massive suppressor on the end of it. And it's it's so brutal. I just wonder, Luke, what did you make of the violence in this film? Was it, you know, did it add to the story? Was it relevant to the story? Or was there too much violence? Was it just right? What did you think?
I don't think it was too much violence, because I don't actually think necessarily that you don't see that much. You see violence, but it's not overly bloodshedy. You obviously see blood, and especially when in the scene that you mentioned earlier, you see him patching himself up and you see people patching blood. But in terms of Tarantino violence, for example, it's not violent like that. I think it works really well, and I don't think it's too violent. And I actually,
you know,
think
it's very realistic, I think. In a way, where Tarantino's violence is more kind of
comic book
extreme sensationalism kind of stuff, whereas this is kind of far more real.
But you know what I will just throw in? Sorry, I feel like I've just cut you off there, Luke, and you've been quiet for a while, but I'll come back to you. What I really, once again, credits the Coens here, because they still make it look cinematic. It doesn't have to be over the top. It doesn't have to be, you know, this ridiculous comic book Tarantino-esque violence.
It's not gratuitous either, I don't think.
I could totally agree with you. And I think it's really interesting that you mentioned, Luke, that some of it's off screen, but that's what makes it scary though, is because it's left for you to fucking decipher it. Like I've read the book, like I touched on. I know the fate of how Carla Jean dies in the novel, but in the film, and it's a different interpretation, but you imagine it's just as bloody, if not maybe more violent.
Yeah,
you don't get to see it.
I was killing like it was such a bold move to kill Llewellyn off screen.
Yeah.
To kill, you know, the guy that's set up as the protagonist mm-hmm. of the film, to kill him off screen. You know, when it happened, I was like, that's ballsy. That's such a confident. I think it's such a confident move, though.
Yeah, and to do it in the way they do it, where he's not even killed by Anton. He's just killed by a gang, and you don't get to see it. And I, it'll feed back into when we talk about the ending, so I won't go too heavy on it. But like you said, Liam, I think it's ballsy, and you know, the risk paid off massively for me, definitely. You know what, actually, let's just talk about the ending now. Why not? I feel like we're not going to go through every single story beat, but like you've touched on already, Liam, the ending kind of comes out of nowhere. So essentially how it ends is you have Sheriff Bell and his wife sitting down for breakfast one morning, and he's telling her that he's decided that he's going to, you know, retire, leave being...
But he has retired at this point, though, because he says he is retired. That's another thing where it's happened off screen.
Yeah, true.
He's retired off screen, and it's not shown that he's retired. It's just he just says, well, I'm retired now, so you know it's in the future. And it's just that kind of... You just have to figure it out for yourself.
You kind of see him. He tells his wife about two dreams he had. And the first one is about him and his dad. Is it right? Him? No, the first one's about him, you know, making a journey over a mountain, and he's carrying this torch. And then he moves on to the second story about him and his dad and how his dad tried to give him money, but he wouldn't take it until eventually he took it or something. And then he says that the final line is, and then I woke up and the film ends. And normally if I saw that in a Michael Bay film or a Chris Nolan film,
I would lose my
fucking mind, and I'd say this is awful, it makes no sense, why would you do that? But the way the Coens and the way Tommy Lee Jones actually plays this character, you can kind of tell he's world weary. He's always making these self-deprecating jokes, and he's always kind of he's trying to almost cover up that this world isn't for him anymore, you know, the gratuitous nature of crime. And, you know, the sensationalist violence that is happening on a daily basis is just kind of, you know,
it's almost like the surprise in that he surprises himself when he remembers or realizes that he's dreaming about his dad who died when he was 20 years younger than he is now.
Mm-hmm.
So he was like, in a way, I'm older than my dad in my dream. And that's like really quite powerful, I think, and it's another way of thinking, you know, if you go into his head, how he probably feels like maybe this is he's accepting that it's probably, you know, it for him, you know, he's probably, you know, it's his the final stages of his life. He's, you know, he's retired now, he probably doesn't have much left to do other than sit back and kind of just accept that the world as he knows it is probably not how he wants it to be.
Yeah.
And it's like trying to accept that and trying to maybe live with that for the final years of his life.
Not to tie it in too neat of a ribbon, but he's the old man at the end of the story. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
There is no room. There's no country for him anymore. Everything that he loved and his way of life is unfortunately past him now. And I really like that. And I think that's what makes it so, not gut-wrenching, but so kind of impactful at the end, where it feels really raw and really unfortunate almost.
And it does, it ties the film up perfectly because he's, you know, he narrates the opening of the film and then he closes the end of the film.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just neat, kind of almost simplistic storytelling in a way, but done in like the most perfect way that it's, you know, it's almost impossible to do for most people. I think obviously we spoke about the actual ending, but the scene just before that, I suppose, is the ending of Shiger, or is it, you know, what happens with him, which is also ambiguous. I think it's interesting that he goes through all of this shit, being a crazy bastard, killing everyone. You know, he's he's just a mass murderer, isn't he? He's
yeah,
a lunatic mass murderer. But what actually throws him off guard right at the end is a car crash. You know, it's not like he drives through a green light. You know, the light's green and someone comes through the other way and hits him. And, you know, his bones popping out of his arm.
Yeah.
And, but you can see he looks quite scared and shaken, and he's not scared or shaken when he's been shot at, but he's scared and shaken because he didn't see this coming. Mm-hmm. And you can tell because he is such a meticulous character, you know, this has thrown everything, you know, out of order, I guess, in his head. And I think that's kind of like the psychopath element, you know, everything has to be meticulously in place and this has completely thrown him off guard and he doesn't like it. And he asks a couple of young lads to, he asks one of them to give him a t-shirt so he can tie a little sling for his arm. And it's that one moment of interaction in the whole film where you don't even sense at all that he's going to kill these people. Like he's genuinely just wants help from this lad. And then he walks off. And that to me, I don't know if it says that he's going to survive and maybe stop what he's doing, or is he going to survive and just carry on being a murderous, crazy nutter?
That's the ambiguity, though, isn't it? That's the kind of middle ground, the moral middle ground that this film deals in. And I really, really like that.
The last thing we see, the last time we see this horrible person in the film, you know, he's involved in an act of kindness. He's receiving an act of kindness from someone.
And the way they frame him as he's obviously the one in need with the kind of frame.
Yeah, like
high
he
angle.
Sat down, yeah, and like the kids are high. Yeah, yeah, no, it's really... What did you make of that, Luke?
I don't know which bit now where... I'll start from the Tommy Lee Jones bit. I just thought the end... Honestly, the end was the weakest bit for me. It was inconsistent with the rest of the film and not like... and I think that comes from killing Josh Brolin's character, which I don't think was a bad move. I just think it throws things off kilter slightly because it's not a bad move, but then they go on to Cigar, as they say in the film. With his wife and then obviously killing her. So I think that bit all actually does wrap it in a neat bow.
Mm-hmm.
But then I think that the bit with Tommy Lee Jones' character, that's the sheriff, it felt almost like it had been tacked on from a different film.
It feels really sudden, doesn't it? Yeah.
Yeah, it does feel quite sudden. But in terms of I liked the bit with Sagar and obviously the car accident. I just think that was, I don't know, I actually quite like sometimes when you watch a film and you can, like, as soon as the camera goes into the car as he's just gone through a junction, you know he's getting hit by a car.
Yeah.
Like, you don't, before he gets hit by the car.
I
like that because it almost, and it sounds really daft, but as like a, you almost feel in on it before, not everyone else, but before it happens and you're like, I kind of know what's going to happen here. And I just like that little bit where the kid just gives him his shirt, and it's quite a nice interaction. And he does look, I think you were right, Liam, he does look, he looks shaken up, especially when they kind of zoom into his face and obviously his eyes battered in and the bones sticking out of his arm. And he does look a little bit, almost like, I think what it actually reminded me of, I didn't necessarily think of this before Liam was mentioning it, but when you said it then, you know, in there's the quote in The Dark Knight where he says that when things don't go to plan, that's when it really shakes people up. And yeah, it's almost like his plan all the way through was to do all the things that he was doing. And then the thing that didn't go to plan, because he planned to go through a green light, because that's what you're supposed to do, it shook him up a bit more. So that bit I really liked, yeah. But I just think the Tommy Lee Jones bit, for all that was great with him in the film, it just threw me slightly.
I fully get that. And it's one of those things where, like I touched on when we were talking about, you know, the first time you watched it and how it left us feeling at the end of it. And I think that scene especially kind of made me be a bit like, oh, all right. Okay, like,
yeah,
I only on multiple watchings and, you know, reading up on it and hearing what people think about it, am I like, oh, okay, it might, you know, there is a way to read it where it works out, but definitely I found it really jarring on first watch.
I feel like you're almost willing Llewellyn to be the guy that kind of makes it to the end and him to be, you know, all right in the end, but I think it's quite apparent, you know, maybe like halfway through the film, that there's no way he can survive. There's absolutely no chance he can survive. Yeah. He's in too deep in it, and, you know, he's injured. He's in a bad way, and the only way is death.
Yeah.
And I think ultimately it does make sense to have, you know, the end of the film, you know, to focus on the sheriff. I feel like he's almost, yeah, okay, I know that, you know, he is the guy, you know, who doesn't fit into this world, but he almost does represent this kind of hope that there is still good in the world as well. And to end on someone, you know, with that is, you know, represents that kind of positivity in a film that, you know, does have, you know, there's assassins, you know, murderers, and it's quite a lot of bleak people in this film, but, you know, just a good person that just wants to do better and wants to improve the world. I think.
Yeah. I think quite that's important. That's actually quite interesting, because I was just thinking as you were speaking, because as regularly happens on this podcast, that there are things that, especially you guys, I think who may think about films slightly different to me, will say, and I'll join the dots from that. I think what threw me off, just to go slightly back to that, was, and it links in with what Liam said about positivity, was the fact that, let's say at least the last 45 minutes are conducted in the dark, and it's all quite grim, and it's all quite so the whole story is a little bit grim and a little bit grungy, and then the last scene with Tommy Lee Jones' character, the sheriff, is like really bright. It's him looking back at either his life or his dream or whatever that means, and it's almost like I think that what hit me was the tone had completely gone in between a couple of seconds, that even with it being just in the daylight. And I think maybe that's what it was. But with you guys talking about it, it is quite an interesting ending, really, though. And I think maybe, like Connor said, like it might be a case of, like, because I will, you know, this will probably go on my list of films to kind of rewatch when I want something familiar, because I quite liked it. Mm-hmm. It may be a case of, you know, in a year's time, if we sit down and say, okay, so what do you make of the ending then? I wouldn't be surprised if maybe I was more fond of it. But yeah.
That's interesting. So, what were you going to say, Liam? You can go.
I was going to say, where does this film kind of rank with you guys in the Coens?
I had this question put down, and I didn't want to answer it because I love them all. So, I don't know. I think it's hard for me because I am a notorious advocate and defender for The Big Lebowski. I think it's fucking perfect.
It's a great film.
It's a weird kind of stoner noir film, and I love it. But I also don't think Lebowski's as good as Fargo, which I think is their best film.
I've not seen Fargo.
Probably up there.
Okay. I've never seen Fargo either.
Oh, well, coming to a podcast near you. Fargo coming soon. Anyway, for me, this is up there with Fargo as one of the best films they've made.
But I think I really like... sorry, Luke.
No, go ahead, mate.
I love Burn After Reading. I think it's brilliant. I've not seen that. It's really fun. Mm-hmm. It's great fun. It's almost... It's them, the most playful film of theirs I've seen.
Mm-hmm.
Though I've only seen like four of their films. I don't like, the one I really don't like is The Ballad of Buster Scruggs. I don't think it works. Sorry, Connor.
Connor's, I can see Connor's, you know, face what? Here. And he's so
I get different. It though, because the very first, like it's a film told in six different kind of mini parables almost. And some of them don't tie in with the others, and there is no really real narrative through line. I kind of get what you mean. But I love all the individual stories, but just not as one film. So fair point.
Yeah, yeah. I like the opening, the opening little anthology short thing with what's his name? What's his name? William something, isn't it?
Yeah, Buster Scruggs.
Tim Blake Nelson playing. Yeah, Buster Scruggs.
So for you, look, where would you put this one if you could rank them?
I haven't seen many. I haven't seen many Coen Brothers films. Mm. I have obviously as we've just said, I haven't seen Fargo, which is like actually like I made a film list a few weeks ago, and it didn't. Not I didn't make it on there, but I forgot all about it, and that probably would be quite high on that film list.
It's so good, man.
But I like Burn After Reading, and I saw it quite a long time ago. So long ago that I'm pretty sure I rented it from an actual rental shop.
Extra Vision.
Which is Blockbuster. but I think I like it more than... So we did The Big Lebowski, didn't we, on quite an early episode? Maybe the first episode ever? Was it the first episode ever?
It might have been episode two.
Wasn't it? Yeah.
Maybe.
Oh, was it? Well, we did it on that, and I did like that. And But I think this would be higher up there, maybe.
Yeah, I agree.
I've got real eyes to eventually see inside Llewellyn Davis, or Davies, however you say it, but I haven't seen that yet. So I suppose automatically for me, really, it just goes to the top, but that's, having said that, I haven't seen loads, so.
Oh, yeah, Raising Arizona as well is great. That's another kind of, it's fun,
isn't
it? It's
a fun movie, man, yeah. They know what they're so good at. They're good at making really idiosyncratic characters that you just fall in love with. And it's one of their strongest points as filmmakers.
Their first film's meant to be great. It's Blood Simple.
Blood Simple, yeah. I've not saw that one either yet, but I've heard...
I'm just going through their filmography now, and I've barely seen Coen Brothers films, to be honest.
All right, so let's just do one quick point then before we wrap up. I just want to talk. Have you guys got a favorite scene or moment or even shot or piece of dialogue from the film that you want to talk about?
My favorite scene, and it's a bit of a weird one. I did mention it before, and it is the scene. Well, actually, it's the scene leading up to it as well, and the actual scene Javier Bardem. What's his name?
Anton. Big Tony. Tony Sugar, yeah.
I've had such an issue with names in this film for some reason. Sugar, yeah. He blows up the car outside the pharmacy, steals the drugs from the pharmacy. Then the next scene, he is treating himself for a massive shotgun wound in his leg. And it's so meticulous, the way it's shot, the close-ups, the effects that they use, it looks surreal. He just doesn't even wince at all as he's doing all these intricate, you know, he's using tweezers to pick the little bits of shotgun shell out of his leg. It's a scene that completely sums him up, I think, as a lunatic, the lunatic that he is. Yeah, that's one that really stood out for me. It really kind of, I don't know, it just kind of engaged me more into the film. I don't know why I found it so, it was almost satisfying to watch in the same way that, you know, the scene in Toy Story 2 when the toy guy is cleaning Woody ready for auction.
Yeah, that is very satisfying.
Yeah, I love that scene.
Such a satisfying.
I love that scene.
Almost felt the same satisfaction from watching him pull bits of bullet out of his leg.
That's just your progression as a man from Toy Story to Shotgun Show.
Yeah, I'm sure it is. Damn straight.
I think my favorite scene, which I thought Liam was going to say was his favorite scene, and I was even in my head being like, God damn it, I should have just like, halfway through the question, just like start shouting it out loud. was the gas station scene
that's probably my favourite scene. Actually.
not the Toy Story 3 ripoff or whatever it was.
What I'll do is I'll say this as my favourite scene, and then while I'm saying it, I'll try and think if it compares to anything from one of the four Toy Story films. but no, I love that because it was actually, it goes back to what you guys were saying before about it's actually a lot scarier and tenser than many horror films that you will watch, really. And I mean, the horror genre is one that I love one of the most, but also understand has the most shit in it. So not many horror films are that scary. But I think in general, like, that is really tense. And it's tense because the gas station guy is like just this guy, you know, he's not like, it's because, you know, if there was some shit was to go down between these two people, the gas station guy hasn't got a frigging chance. Yeah. So therefore you are like really feeling for him in the situation. He's kind of awkward and that brings on the tension a lot more. So yeah, that's my favorite scene. How about you, Connor, mate?
I will go with there's one really small moment, and then there's one that kind of is an extrapolation of that. So after Josh Brolin has been killed, there's a scene where Sheriff Bell walks into the room that he's been killed in, and obviously the body's been taken away. But you kind of get this low angle shot of his silhouette up against the wall, very Roger Deakins, but it's framed as if he's a cowboy. Do you know what I mean? You know, you're onto the one I'm on about. So you can, his hands are by his side, almost like he's got a gun in his holster, but he doesn't. Yeah. And I just think that's such an interesting, like how you mentioned, Liam, where it sums up the scene you talked about, it sums up Anton as a character. I think this kind of almost sums up Sheriff Bell as a character, where this is essentially like a neo-Western. It's a Western film told with like through a new lens. And this is kind of the progression of a character of you know, maybe a, he's essentially the hero of this film, essentially. He's the paragon for good. Whereas, you know, the old cowboy would have been in Westerns. But nowadays, there's no country for that. There's no time for that. This is what it is now. And it's far from the glamorous lifestyle you would have saw one of those characters live out.
Quick shout out to... sorry, Connor. I thought you'd
finish. No. It's fine.
Quick shout out to the shot in the film. Well, it's the same shot's done twice with two different characters. It's the reflection in the TV.
That was my next one.
Oh, yeah. It's so good.
Three of them sit on the exact same seat as well. There's something in that. I've not figured it out yet.
But well, you know what? Can I shout out to another one if we're going to do this? And yeah, I feel like if we had like a checklist of all the scenes, I feel like we may end up just ticking them all off by the end of this conversation. But it was the one at the very beginning where they're out on the plains of the sand of the desert area. And it's nighttime, and again, like Liam, forgot the character name, but Josh Brolin's character is just kind of having a little sneak peek around, and he's running away from the van that's chasing him, and he comes over like that over the horizon, and then the van does, and you get that silhouette of him just coming just towards the camera, I suppose. So it's so really good. Like, it's fucking like properly excellent. And so I just thought we couldn't really go through, I don't think, this podcast without just mentioning that slightly.
Yeah. Once again, we are a Roger Deakins fan club on this podcast. He's just a genius, isn't he? All right, cool. So that only leaves popcorns then, fellas. As it was you guys, it was your first tick. I'll let one of you start. So Luke, if you want to go first, mate.
Yeah, definitely. Good question. I never think about this until someone says popcorns and I've got 5 seconds to think. I'm going to go with 83. Ooh, I just really thoroughly enjoyed it, more than I thought I was going to.
I'm going to go for 79 popcorns because I did when it first finished, I wasn't 100% sold on it, and yeah, now I am. I feel like I've convinced myself that it is an exceptional film.
Yeah.
Not that I didn't think it was exceptional. I could, you know, definitely respect a lot about the film, but I wasn't 100%. Yeah, this is my first take, 79.
I think I would give it 85. On first take, probably, you know, like you said, Liam, I think we felt pretty similar after watching it the first time. But now with this added love for it and on whatever number watch, I've watched it now, I think I'd give it 85. I still don't think it should have won Best Picture, man. Give it to Paul Thomas Anderson. Give it to There Will Be Blood, please. Let's VAR it. Bring it back.
If we're gonna be real here, this film also went up against Atonement and Juno, and I prefer both of them I prefer Juno and Atonement over this and There Will Be Blood. Sorry, Atonement might be my favorite out of all of them films, to be honest.
What, really? Have you saw Atonement, Luke?
No.
We should probably do it. It's a good movie, man. I really like it.
I was so
Just fancy Keira Knightley, you big creep.
No, I was genuinely so surprised. I wasn't expecting much. This is going to sound really bad, but like Laura suggested it to me, and not that she doesn't have good taste in films, but I just thought it was like a rom-com. No, not a rom-com. I thought it was like a romantic period piece. But what it is a complete subversion on a romantic period piece, and I loved it. I think it's great.
All right, cool. We've got two good recommendations for the podcast then, with Atonement and Fargo. I think that'd be pretty good to back to back. All right, cool. So before we get off then, let me just do a quick plug on socials, because I forgot to do it earlier because I was a little bit nervous. So if you want to get in touch, maybe suggest some films or tell us how good we are at the podcast, or any other. If you want to be mean, you can be mean. Just hit us up.
Tell Connor how good he was. I think you've done really well. Connor.
Thank you.
Yeah, he's done really well.
Thank you. I appreciate really that, boys. I want to do it a bit more. I just get a bit nervous sometimes.
No. Don't get ahead of yourself. No, it's still going to be the Liam and Luke show.
Okay. Well, for now, I don't mind being a side character. I'll just edit it every week. No worries.
See, what it is actually we are Javier Bardem and Josh Brolin. And actually, to come out strong at the end of it is Connor as Tommy Lee Jones.
Just Connor's going to outlive both of us.
Well, there's no country for me by the signs of it. anyway, you can find us at First Take Pod on Twitter and Instagram. And if you want to hit us up on Facebook, it's just First Take Film Club. Don't look for the website. We don't know if that exists anymore. And the website we were giving you, that wasn't even the right name anyway. So get us on socials on those, and until next week, which we'll be covering North by Northwest.
Oh yeah,
the Alfred Hitchcock film coming to the podcast, and one that you can find on BBC iPlayer if you want to watch it before next week's episode. So until then, guys, see you later.